This is an ad from BetterHelp. As kids, we were always learning and growing. But at some point, as adults, we tend to lose that sense of curiosity and excitement. Therapy can help you continue that journey because your back-to-school era can come at any age. And BetterHelp makes it easy to get started with affordable online therapy you can do from anywhere. Rediscover possibility with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com today to get 10% off your first month.
Hey, Prime members, are you tired of ads interfering with your favorite podcasts? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app for free or go to Amazon.com/ad-free podcasts. That's Amazon.com/ad-free podcasts to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Transfers Podcast, powered by footballtransfers.com, a new podcast where we bring you news, insight and analysis on that most important of the least important things, football. I'm Ronan Murphy, and this week I'm delighted to be joined by, as always, Duncan Castles, but also Paul McDonald. Paul McDonald is actually my big boss at Football Transfers, and in the show notes, Duncan told me to call him the big boss, so I better keep calling him the big boss throughout. And Paul McDonald, he's the brainchild behind ETV, estimated transfer value at Football Transfers, and it's his big brain that we're looking to pick today, so myself and Duncan can hopefully try our best to see what comes from that.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
Great to finally get you on the podcast, Paul. I've been thinking about having you on all through the summer and finding a hole in that busy schedule of yours.
It's been an interesting window, Duncan, having listened to your pods religiously over the summer and getting under the bonnet of why things are happening but also not happening for various reasons, which I'm sure we'll go into in a bit more detail in the course of this podcast.
This will be obviously the last edition of the Transfers Podcast before Friday's Premier League transfer deadline, so it's going to be a very busy show, a very busy few days, so we'll try and pack as much as we can in today. So, and to celebrate that kind of final episode before the closing up the window, we're going to throw in a little Transfers Podcast Easter egg at the end of this episode. So please listen to the whole show. So we better get kick things off. So I think, Duncan, you want to talk about Rodri to get us started today.
Yeah, I'm missing your section on Irish football here, but we'll go straight into Rodri because we've only got a certain amount of time. This is actually something which I think will be a big factor once the transfer window is closed. And something we're going to be discussing over the months ahead. And that is that Florentino Perez has instructed Real Madrid's recruitment staff to do everything possible to bring Rodri to the club. Probably in the next summer's transfer window will be the target. He is aware that Rodri has 3 years left in his contract at Manchester City, and Manchester City want to improve that contract to make him one of the best paid players at the club in line with his performances at the club. And also Manchester City are aware of Madrid's interest in taking the player. I think it's quite easy to understand where Perez is coming from, top player in the Spain national team, widely regarded as the best defensive midfielder in football at present. Just turned 28, recently joined Manchester City in 2019 with City paying a then record transfer fee, the 70 million euro release clause from Atletico Madrid. And I think it's been one of the most successful transfers in recent, not just English football history, but European football history. Rodri's played at least 33 Premier League matches in every season since. He's won 4 Premier League titles in 5 years, 9 major trophies, including a Champions League. He was a Euro 24 player of the tournament, 22-23 Champions League player of the season. Only thing he hasn't won is England's Footballer of the Year awards, because the English prefer to vote for Phil Foden in these things. Told about it, I think Rodri is interested in this. There has also been approaches from Barcelona, which are, I think, are far less realistic for the reasons we all know about on this podcast, with Barcelona's financial situation. But moving to Real Madrid, the most successful team in Europe, I think still the favourites for the Champions League this season, opportunity to finish his career in Spain. I think that is something that will be taken seriously, and obviously ramps up the pressure and places him in an excellent position to maximise the contract offer he receives, not just from Manchester City, but also the one that will come from Real Madrid.
Yeah, you will be expecting to pay a lot of money to keep a player like that around, or entice a player like that to come to your team. And you mentioned all his trophies that he'd won, and you said the one he hasn't won, I was waiting for you to say the Ballon d'Or maybe at the end, and that will be an interesting one for Real Madrid to sign the Ballon d'Or winner, and it not being Kylian Mbappe. It would be maybe some egg on Mbappe's face if Rodri was to go on and win that this season, because obviously he's one of the favourites for that trophy. And yeah, we'll just wait and see what happens there.
I would say, in Rodri's case, fantastic generational player in his position. But he will be 29 before the next season starts. He still has 3 years left in his contract. City aren't going to let a guy like this leave on the cheap. And maybe, I'm not suggesting that Rodri is not fit. He's clearly a super fit player, but there's a lot of mileage on those legs. He plays pretty much every time he's fit. What do you think, Duncan, about his longevity in the game? And it does seem like the antithesis of Real Madrid's recent transfer policy to go after much younger talent than to go after someone who's potentially reaching the end of his career and having to pay a lot of money to get him.
Yeah, absolutely. That would be a factor. I think where Real Madrid have been clever in the recruitment is, and this is something we haven't seen with Chelsea, who we'll talk about later, is that they've always retained a spine of experienced players in amongst these young talents. And talking to people involved who've been involved in building some of the best teams in Europe, they emphasise the importance of that. You can't go purely for youth. You need to have those players in. I guess that would potentially be a factor that Rodri would be considering in terms of his own career. Is it a benefit to him to leave the Premier League and move to La Liga, where there would be lesser demands on him on a week-to-week basis? Where does Rodri sit on the estimated transfer value at present, Paul?
He's just under the 100 million euro mark, so 97.6 million, which, to give the listeners a bit more detail, is our ETV is very focused on the younger talents and the developing talents, simply because the market has kind of shifted more towards the younger players, not only this summer, but probably last. And we'll talk about that in a bit more detail in a bit. But the fact that Rodri is still valued so highly when he's about to turn 29, and his value is still increasing as he gets to that age, is testament just to how good a player he is, and how much City will likely demand for him if he were to move on.
Just to throw a little detail here that the listeners probably aren't aware of on Rodri, he was actually recommended to Jose Mourinho as a Manchester United signing in 2017, when he was still at Villarreal. He subsequently joined Atletico Madrid 2018 for 20 million euros. And Mourinho went for Nemanja Matic instead. Interesting to think what could have happened there if Manchester United had decided to pay what was actually considered quite a high fee at the time. But has been demonstrated to be, I think, way below potential market value of what he turned into as a player.
That's Manchester United spending on midfielders, and that probably brings us nicely into our next topic, Man United spending on a midfielder, because it seems one in, one out. There's a revolving door of midfielders at Manchester United. as the window closes, we get obviously a big name signing and one to whet the appetites of Manchester United fans because they love these big name signings. But yeah, what's the latest on the movers and shakers at Old Trafford, Duncan?
Yeah, well, Manuel Ugarte has been the one that we've talked about in this podcast, I think, since early July. We revealed that the asking price from Paris Saint-Germain was going to be no less than 60 million euros for the Uruguay international, and that they'd entered discussions with Manchester United for the player. That was resolved on Monday night, the fee, and Ugarte travelled to Manchester yesterday to start his medical, and the expectation is that that will be completed today and the deal will be announced maybe before we finish this podcast, maybe later in the day. The details we broke on Football Transfers yesterday, 50 million euros guaranteed fee, 10 million euros of performance related variables. Paris Saint-Germain also cheekily inserted a sell-on clause. We discussed in the podcast last week that there'd been a fair degree of tension between Nasser Al-Khelaifi and Jim Ratcliffe over the negotiations on this deal. And I think it's interesting there's a sell-on clause in a deal to a club like Manchester United. It seems to express a bit of concern about whether United will be able to retain a player and whether they'll have the status to retain this player down the line. Also understand, however, that deal, the sell-on clause will come into effect if Ugarte signs a new contract at Manchester United. The expectation from the Paris Saint-Germain end is that they will receive 60 million. They feel that the way it's been structured, they'll get to that in the end. As we've discussed in the pod, there was a big fight over that deal. I'm told that that during the discussions, and I think this is important to underline for Manchester United supporters, during the discussions, PSG's negotiating team told Manchester United's recruitment team that they did not want to lose the player, that they were only selling because Luis Enrique wasn't using the player to the extent that they would have liked, and the player was pushing for a move, and they expected him to be one of Manchester United's best players down the line. Whether United's recruitment team believed that or not, thought it was a negotiating tactic, I think that is actually genuine from the PSG end. And we'll wait and see how Ugarte performs in Manchester United's midfield this season. Paul, what's your assessment of the fee that United ended up paying for the player?
Our ETV for Ugarte is 41 million euros, which actually is a pretty solid starting position from Man United in terms of where they opened the bidding. So that makes logical sense from their perspective. I think at this point of the window, as you know, teams get desperate and end up spending a little bit more to get something over the line in order to give the manager what they need for the season. And I think they started in a logical position. Like they did in the cases of Jarrod Branthwaite with Everton, but I think the difference here is the need is much more palatable for United, and I think they're probably more willing to go that extra mile and spend a little bit over the value in order to get a guy that feel that they really need for this season.
Yeah, I think there's been an emphasis that the recruitment team felt they needed a high combat ball winning midfielder, and Ugarte certainly fits that profile. They've allowed Scott McTominay to go to Napoli to raise cash for this deal. The details I've been given on that are that the final transfer fee is 13.5 million, all of that guaranteed, no performance-related bonuses, and Manchester United retain a 10% sell-on clause. Napoli also been trying to sign Billy Gilmore from Brighton and Hove Albion, which begs a question of what Antonio Conte was doing during the Euros and why he decided that what he really needed were Scotland internationals to win the Scudetto again.
Yeah, he certainly wasn't any of the games I was at the Euros, put it that way.
As an Irishman, I have no comment on the Euros. I have no comment on a performance of an international team. It's better to be there and to have fun than be sitting at home watching from afar.
I think in the case of McTominay, actually, that's that's kind of double the value that we've got him at in the system. We've got him valued ATV of €15 million. Just most of that is tied into the fact that his contract runs out next summer. So if United can get that fee for him, obviously that's a very good deal for them, and it obviously offsets a lot of what they're about to spend on Ugarte.
So I think one of the biggest transfer fees Manchester United have secured for a number of years. So yes, to go double estimated transfer value on top of that is, yeah, it's an impressive bit of negotiating on their part, I think.
Yeah, I think there's a full other pod in that, Duncan, about how other clubs have managed to secure value for players that they've sold over the last decade, and United clearly haven't in a lot of cases. That's a full separate podcast all of its own to talk about those dealings of the club sales.
The Man United Bad Transfers podcast. Think of it its full title, perhaps. So one that's flummoxed a lot of listeners, I think, at the moment. One rumour we've seen this week is the Jadon and Raheem Sterling kind of swap deal. Where's that come from and what's going on with that one, Duncan?
Yeah, that's not a rumour. That is actually under discussion at present. David Ornstein, who we had in the podcast last week, reported on it yesterday, I believe. Look, I think this is a fascinating bit of discussion, which actually tells us quite a lot about where the transfer market, where recruitment is, where these clubs are at the moment. Because you're looking at two of the best paid players in the Premier League, i.e. two of the highest valued players in terms of what clubs have been prepared to give them on salary, actually in the history of the English game. You go back 3 years and Manchester United paid €85 million for Jadon Sancho from Borussia Dortmund. And at present, he isn't even getting into the 20-man squad for the first two Premier League games. And we know the reasons for this. We know that there's a huge fallout with Erik ten Hag. I think on the podcast we've talked about the details of that, the training ground fight where Ten Hag told Sancho if he wasn't prepared to work on pressing, he should walk off the pitch. And Sancho took him at his word and walked off the pitch. And you've got to a scenario where Manchester United need to trade out of Jadon Sancho's contract. There are a very small number of potential buyers given the huge salary he's on. And we'll mention here that Juventus are interested in the deal and may actually be the eventual outlet because they can't afford to pay a transfer fee. And they do want to spend this summer to kind of create some enthusiasm amongst the supporters, having gone four seasons without a Scudetto. But in England, where you'd think the natural home would be for Sancho, very limited options. But what you do have is Chelsea with a similar situation with Raheem Sterling, again, paid over £300,000 a week, signed for a big fee, £47.5 million, 2 years ago, just after clearly it came into the club. And when Manchester City actively wanted to offload Sterling, and I think we're happy to see Chelsea give them that money and take the salary from them. So Sterling's had his squad number taken off him, excluded from the squad, told that he should find somewhere else to play. And you then get this kind of discussion of convenience, which is, will you guys be prepared to take Sterling and give us some kind of transfer fee? If that's the case, we'll be prepared to take Jadon Sancho at some kind of transfer fee, because that allows both of us to do an accounting exercise where we get a PSR benefit from it. And we might not reduce our wage bill, but at least we help with the accounting and the balance that we're able to spend on other players going forward. Now, like the guidance I have from the Manchester United end is this: they feel it's an unlikely deal to get over the line. Loads of complications, obviously, in terms of satisfying the two players' demands as well as everything else that's involved. But they are actively exploring and discussing that at the moment. And I think, Paul, that it really is indicative of where the Premier League has got itself in terms of past spend on transfer fees and the wages that are handed to players who those transfer fees are spent on.
Yeah, so Sancho and Sterling are two quintessential examples of the collapse of value in terms of ETV. When Sancho went to United 3 years ago, his ETV in our system jumped to 101 million euros. And likewise with Sterling, it's difficult to remember now, given how poor he's been at Chelsea. But when they signed him, even though on paper it looked like a bad deal, he still was a serial league winner with City, playing regularly, scoring regularly. And his value jumped to 91 million off the back of that move to Chelsea. Fast forward 2 years, and Sterling is valued at 52 million euros and Sancho at 41 million. And really the only difference there is really contract length. Sterling still has 4 years remaining, and I think Sancho only has two. And it's an example of overspending or spending too much on a player in this market, as we've discussed, Duncan. It's so much harder to extricate yourself from a bad deal now than it maybe was 4 or 5 years ago, where there are multiple teams that could have helped you out and at least taken them with a loan to buy. Now it's just so much harder to get these guys out of these deals because teams aren't spending like they did before, but also they're just not willing to kind of stump up for such exorbitant salaries as well.
I think the Sterling thing is a prime example of maybe the Chelsea long contract that we're seeing. It's going to make it hard for them to get rid of players in the long run. It's not going to be Sterling. We're going to see this maybe time and time again in the future, that players that are cast off this bomb squad that they have at the moment, it's going to be very difficult for them to get rid of a lot of these big names. Obviously they are moving on some players, but I think a lot of Chelsea fans probably didn't want to see Conor Gallagher or Gallagher. I'm not sure. I'm too preoccupied with the Liam and Noel Gallagher coming back for Oasis to pronounce Conor Gallagher's name right. But with Conor Gallagher moving on, I think a lot of Chelsea fans were sad about that or disappointed to see him leave. But maybe someone like Kepa, they probably won't be too concerned to see him be moved out of the club. Yeah. What's going on at Chelsea at the moment?
Yeah, they're both interesting deals in terms of offloading players. Gallagher moved to Atletico Madrid for a fee that could reach 42 million euros in total. Obviously didn't want to leave the club. The player who was used the most by Pochettino last season, and a number of people in football questioning the logic of moving a player like that out. Chelsea's excuse or reasoning has been that it was done for technical reasons, because they didn't see him being a first choice in their new midfield of over 100 million signings, two of them plus Romeo Lavia, which is, I think, is fair to say, yet to prove itself. Got some interesting detail on the negotiations they had with Gallagher, who had 1 year left in his contract, and they've indicated that they offered him a new deal, and he refused to take that deal, and that's why they were forced to sell. What I've been told is that he was on around £45,000 a week on his previous deal. He was asking for £150,000 a week, which I don't think is unreasonable, and I don't canvas your opinion on that, Paul, but I don't think that's unreasonable for his performance levels, his analytic levels in the Premier League and being an English player. And they responded with £80,000 a week and only a 2 year deal with a 1 year option, which is essentially forcing the player out. Kepa Arrizabalaga, interesting in a different way. A player that Chelsea had to get off their wage bill, has agreed to join Bournemouth on loan. And that's it's a straightforward loan, no option to buy on Bournemouth's behalf. It has been reported that he's taken an extension of his contract for a further year to allow this loan to happen. What I've been told is that what has happened in his contract is that Chelsea now have an option to extend his contract for a further year, which they do not have to take up. So he will potentially be a free agent at the end of this year at Bournemouth if he doesn't perform well. If he does perform well, Chelsea can take him back. But he's also accepted around a 50% pay cut in order to play for Bournemouth this season. So I think they've been fortunate there in that Kepa has found a club who want to take him, and he wants the opportunity to play football in the Premier League, and he's prepared to salary sacrifice and actually place himself in quite a precarious position in terms of having to perform well this season to look for a good contract and further down the line to move elsewhere.
The Conor Gallagher deal could be an interesting jump-off point, Duncan, to actually talk about some of the transfer jiggery-pokery, as I've kind of coined it this summer, in terms of how and why clubs are incentivised to sell homegrown talent and how this can be apportioned on the books. Now, I don't want to make this like an episode of The Big Short or something like that, but it is really all financial. Obviously, guys like Conor Gallagher are youth products, so there is no inherent cost on the books for Chelsea. So when they sell him, they bank the profit completely in that season. Whereas if people who've been listening to the podcast in the past know, if you sign a player, you can amortise that player's contract over the fee for it over the length of the contract. So one of the reasons why Chelsea are signing guys on such long contracts is because if Mudryk costs 80 million, they can put 10 million of that cost across 8 years of Mudryk's contract length rather than putting it all in the books in the one season. So you can bank 100% of your profit by selling youth products. And this clearly wasn't something that the Premier League wanted to happen, but it's happened in multiple places this summer where there's been cases, particularly with Chelsea as well, in the case of Omari Kellyman, who they picked up from Aston Villa for £22.5 million. Duncan, I think you've got some details on potentially that being subject to some scrutiny. But in the case of Kellyman, and from our perspective as a website trying to value players, it becomes really, really difficult and becomes a minefield to try and value young talents who have no discernible data set behind them to justify any kind of valuation. Like, Omari Kellyman might be a very good player. He might turn out to be a regular Premier League star. But as far as the data that we have available shows right now, we have no idea. So it'll be very interesting to see how both Chelsea and Aston Villa arrived at the value of £22.5 million for Kellyman and what kind of precedent it sets in terms of the transfer market overall.
Yeah, we've had a number of these deals, particularly at the end of June. An interesting one was Nottingham Forest and Newcastle United with Elliot Anderson, who you did have data on, so you have a better idea of valuation on him from the ETV model, but Elliot Anderson moving to Nottingham Forest for £35 million. And Newcastle United signing Nottingham's Greek goalkeeper, Odysseus Vlachodimos, for what I understand was £20 million. Now, he became one of five senior goalkeepers at Newcastle United, and they're still looking to sign another in Burnley's James Trafford. I think that's a deal that could go through in the last few days, something they've been working on all summer, as we've talked about in the podcast. But Vlachodimos didn't even make the squad for the last match at Bournemouth, i.e. wasn't chosen in the first three selected goalkeepers, even though Martin Dubravka was injured. So that is basically an accounting move to give both of them room in their books at the time. And as you point out, multiple deals like that, Omari Kellyman is a good example. Someone Chelsea are already trying to move on. They don't have space for him in the first team squad at the moment. You've got Samuel Ealing Jr. And Enzo Barranquilla, who joined Aston Villa at the same time as they sold Douglas Luiz to Juventus. A total of £28 million in transfer fee commitments for the two of them. And Ealing Jr., I think today or yesterday, was loaned out to Bologna. Barranquilla hasn't made a Premier League squad yet. So it's pretty clear that these deals were done in order to... I think it's still legitimately circumvent the financial fair play, profit and sustainability rules. But there are question marks within the division about this. And there have been other clubs are querying whether these deals are done at fair value. There was warnings put out around the league at the time to be careful about these deals. And I think that assessment of valuation is going to be an important part of that, and maybe the Premier League need to give your call, Paul, and get some of the estimated transfer value data. Because I remember looking through these deals as they were happening and going onto the site and checking the ETVs and the players. And I think all of them, without exception, were below what the site has as a valuation of the player, and sometimes by a huge margin.
Yeah. And a quick anecdotal story for you. In a previous life, I used to work for a prominent accountancy and audit firm. And one of the firms in the space were actively assisting the government in their new tax legislation around about the budget. And we watched the budget as part of our daily routines. And half an hour later, an email came round the desk to everybody in the team explaining to all of the accountants on the ground how to circumvent the legislation that the firm had helped the government put together in the first place. So why am I telling you this? It's because the Premier League are simply chasing their tail here. Accountants and tax people are smarter, quicker, ahead of the game, and they get paid a lot of money to get around stuff like this. And it feels like with Chelsea's situation and with Chelsea's, the women's team and the hotel and all of this stuff and PSR deals like this, it feels like the Premier League are reactive to policy here rather than actually driving the change. And I think until they take this stuff a lot more seriously, they're always going to be behind the eight ball, and you're always going to have clever accountants and clubs that are going to beat them to the punch. And until they take it seriously, it's always going to happen.
Question there is, are they going to take it seriously? We'd have to wait and see. Like Duncan says, if there's enough kind of kickback about these, perhaps they will be forced to take it seriously. But until then, how much of an impact is it having on the league as a whole or football as a whole? Are they willing to turn a blind eye to these things, maybe like Paul's previous employers might have been? Yeah.
Look, I think the Premier League rules are devised by the Premier League club, so it's a two-thirds majority in favour of them, and that's what happens. You clearly have clubs gathering together to help each other out this summer. I think the bigger question is whether it's in the interest of the Premier League, i.e. football in the country, to be trading out good young talents. Selling Conor Gallagher is a good example. Whether you really like him as a player or not, he really should be on the Premier League stage. He shouldn't be moving out of the competition altogether. I think he's capable of contributing at the top end of the Premier League, and they've lost that player because of it. I'm not sure I agree entirely with Jim Ratcliffe. I certainly don't agree with everything Jim Ratcliffe says, but you see Jim Ratcliffe actively complaining about being hemmed in by these rules and saying that it's not in the interest of the overall product. To what extent he's actually interested in the overall product, I think we could have a debate about. But I think his argument that the Premier League is handicapping itself with these rules and then the techniques that are used to circumvent them carries weight. And I think you see part of the effect of this. I don't think it's the sole cause, but you see part of the effect of this in the overall spending in the Premier League this season, and the fact that the biggest deal of the summer so far is a transfer out, Julian Alvarez from Manchester City to Atletico Madrid. And also the biggest deal still completed by a Premier League club is Tottenham Hotspur's purchase of Dominic Solanke at just $65 million if all the contingent payments are made.
So we haven't really seen the same amount of money being spent as last summer. Obviously, last summer was huge. We saw the clubs in the Premier League spend $2.3 billion on new signings in last summer, but this season, it's only been $1.6 billion. That's only kind of moved above the $1.6 billion mark this week with a couple of transfers going through. And I know that Paul has definitely been keeping an eye on. He talks to me regularly at work about things like this, and he has a big week ahead of him. With he's providing numbers, overview, analysis for the BBC for them for transfer deadline day. So it's something that's on Paul's mind at the moment, and I know he has been keeping a close eye on the figure.
Yeah, so the deals that have happened in the last couple of days to nudge it above 1.6, we've had a Riley going to Brighton. We've had Liverpool finally making a signing for Mamar Dashvili from Valencia, and also Arsenal and their protracted move for Mikel Merino finally went through. So that moves it above 1.6, which is still 700 million down on last summer. Now, we've still got 3 days to go, or 2.5 days to go now, so the number might still increase. But if you include the January transfer window, when teams were frightened of PSR, you're looking at not far off half in terms of the spend on 2024 versus where we were in 2023, when it was 3.1 billion in total. So the spending is definitely down. And one thing that alludes to what you guys were saying there about big signings, quote unquote big signings at the top, there's a lot more deals taking place around about the 20 million to 25 million euro range for younger talent that can be potentially developed, but also will have an element of sell-on value. If the player is massively successful, then a big sell-on value. But even if there's issues and it's not doesn't work out as well as it could do, there's still an opportunity to claw back a fair chunk of that fee. So clubs are taking more shots at guys around about that range, and hopefully one pays off for them rather than going for the big blockbuster signings. And just a note on that as well, on blockbuster signings, have a cup of coffee after the call, guys, and take 10 minutes to look at every single signing that took place above 100 million euros, and you won't see many successes in there, put it that way. So I think clubs are more wary of that than ever before, that the big blockbuster bombastic deals, they very rarely actually work out for teams. And I think, whisper it, because we're still in a crazy market, teams are starting to be a bit more logical in terms of how they go about things, and a bit more methodical. I think in the case of Liverpool, and to a lesser extent Man United, there's been a lot more power given to sporting directors to go and understand what a market value is for a player, but also understand that if a player becomes available, it's only to try and improve the squad that's currently there, rather than just making a signing for the sake of it. And I think actually, if you remove Chelsea's extravagant spending, and also Brighton, who are not far off 200 million euros worth of purchases this summer, the market does look really depressed across the rest of the league. And I think teams are just being a lot more considered about how they spend their money, more than ever before.
Yeah, on that shift to youth, I was looking through the 20 highest transfer fees paid by Premier League clubs as of this morning. And only two players in those 20 are over the age of 27. One is West Ham's Max Kilman, who turned 27, I think, in May. And then Mikel Merino, who you just mentioned, who was 28 in June. So you can see where the majority of the money is going, is, as you say, for those younger players. And you know, I think a factor here is that in the past, it would generally be the kind of mid-tier clubs who'd be buying those young players with the idea that they'd give them a short window in the Premier League. If they did well, then they'd sell upwards to the Champions League sides. But as you point out, Manchester United are focused to a large degree on younger players this season. Obviously, that Leny Yoro deal being the absolute biggest example of that, still the second highest fee paid by a Premier League club this season, with 60 million euros guaranteed, going up to 70 million, and I believe the highest deal value of any once you factor in the agents' fees and the really high salary they gave Euro. But they're looking for younger players. I think Liverpool tend to go that way. Tottenham are also going that way. It's probably really only Arsenal who are prepared to buy at what used to be considered the prime age of the market, but it's now actually quite an unusual purchase. I think the other factor, which is very important here, and Paul, you said that the difference in the calendar year spend is what for the Premier League has gone from 3.1 billion to 1.7 billion. So that's a 1.4 billion difference so far, and let's say we get it to about £1 billion after these last few days. I think that a really big factor here is we don't have Saudi Pro League money this summer. Last year, Saudi Pro League made around 900 million euros of transfer fee commitments. At present, they're running at 70% down in that figure. Now, they are deliberately bidding late, and there are deals in play at the moment, as we discussed in the podcast last week with David Ornstein. They've got a later transfer window to operate in, and they've deliberately held their deals late to try and take advantage of the European market. But on top of that, their strategy is to offer lower transfer fees, so they're not going to make up as much of the money even in those last few days, and to offer lower salaries than they were this summer. So there's some deals, for example, Paris Saint-Germain have agreed to sell Milan Skriniar to Al Nassr. They're not happy with the fee, but they've accepted it because they don't think they'll get better elsewhere. Skriniar's still waiting to decide himself whether that salary is worth moving to Saudi Arabia for. Whereas last year, if Al Nassr had come in for a player of Skriniar's type, the salary would not be a question. You know, the player would take it because it would have been three times, perhaps more, what they were on at the current club. There wouldn't be a debate involved. But that dropout in money, I think, basically covers a lot of the drop in the overall Premier League spending. And this is the essential problem of the transfer market. The money has to come from somewhere. Yes, the clubs borrow against future revenues. They borrow against future broadcast revenues. They borrow against a fee. For example, you sell a player for 100 million. That might be paid in five installments over 5 years, but you can go to a financial institution and take a loan against the future installments of those transfer fees and start spending them immediately. But pretty much the majority of clubs in Europe are already tapped out on those methods, and it needs new capital to come in. That's not coming in from TV deals. Again, something we've discussed on the podcast, that even the Premier League TV deal, domestic deal, is effectively in real terms 30% down on what it was for the last deal. There's a limited amount of extra money you can make from sponsorship and attendance at the ground. So if there's no new cash coming in from outside, and you're limited on spending new investment from new owners, for example, then at some point, the spending on players has to stop, regardless of how logical you're being in the allocation of that cash.
Yeah, if I reference the other big four leagues in Europe, Serie A actually are the second highest spenders with around 624 million this summer. And I think the reason for that is there is more of a spending in the middle tier of teams in Serie A. If you look at La Liga, for example, their spend is 435 million. I think over 50% of that is taken up by Atletico, Barca and Real Madrid. Your Leganes and Alaves, these teams further down, if you break down their transfers, they're spending 2-3 million euros a summer. There's just no capacity to spend there. Whereas the spread in Serie A is a bit wider. So you, for example, a team like Bologna have made quite a bit of money from deals for the likes of Zirkzee and Calafiore this summer. So they have money to spend, and they're also in the Champions League. So a team like Bologna are spending 25, 30, 40 million. You've got Roma, Napoli, Juventus, Inter, Milan, teams that will spend 25 to 30 million on a couple of players, and that pushes it all up. Whereas in La Liga and Liga, and to a certain extent the Bundesliga as well, the really smaller teams are not spending anything. They're picking up free transfers, or they're spending very small fees, and the only money that they're spending out is if someone is actually coming to buy one of their players. So if you look at Ligue 1, for example, I think there's six or seven teams in Ligue 1 who haven't spent anything yet. And as you guys discussed in previous pods, there are reasons for that. The Ligue 1 TV deal was only sorted before the season started, so the teams really didn't know how much money they had to spend anyway.
Yeah, I got some additional figures on that this week, and I'm told it's that television deal is effectively 50% down in terms of net income to the French league clubs. And French league clubs are more dependent on TV revenue than clubs in the Premier League, for example.
Yeah, that's a staggering loss for this league going forward. And If you look at League One's numbers, $458 million spend. Well, $170 million roughly of that is PSG, because whilst it may look to the outsider as if they've had a quiet summer, the Gonzalo Ramos deal, which was loan last year with obligation to buy, the obligation came through this summer, and they've still spent $90 million on other guys like Désiré Doué. So there is still spending there. And then Marseille spent a fair chunk of money as well. But once you go down through the rest of League One, there's at least 7 or 8 teams that haven't spent anything and probably won't spend anything at this point. So the reason why Serie A is nudging up above the rest of them is that there are teams with more budgets and just a bit more money to spend in that middle tier than the teams at the bottom end of La Liga and Liga and even the Bundesliga that just either won't spend anything or spending under $10 million.
We should just say, because we've been talking about the shift to youth and you've mentioned PSG spending there, they are remarkable in that their focus has been almost entirely on young talent. Could see another young signing come in. If Skriniar sold, they will go and they'll buy a young right-sided centre-back in these last days of the window. But an analyst called Omar Chowdhury pointed out that the average age of Paris Saint-Germain's starting 11 for the first Ligue 1 game of the season was 22 and a half years. And he said in the last 18 seasons, only 10 starting 11s in the big five leagues have been younger than that starting 11 that PSG fielded. And 6 of them were Lille's in 2017-18. I think there's no coincidence there. That was the Lille side that Luis Campos built and turned into title winners 3 years later. He, of course, is in charge of the recruitment at PSG. But what you see there in terms of the shift in youth, and it's important, one of the biggest spenders in European football has now completely changed their policy from going for overextended, superannuated superstars to trying to pick up the best talents in the European game right at the start of their careers. Coordinate them together into a squad under a coach who actually prefers to have young players because he feels they put more energy in the pitch and have less distractions. And by doing so, they take away one of the big buyers for those players that you're talking about earlier, Paul, the ones you sign and hope to have a sell on value down the line, or the Jadon Sanchos or Raheem Sterling's. So I said a few years back, PSG would have been in the discussion to take Jadon Sancho from Manchester United. They had him on a recruitment list this summer for the left wing position, but he was well down that list. It was a real exploratory discussion. And in the end, they go for a teenager from Stade Rennais, and does he really do it?
I mean, we've discussed the reasons why you just referenced there, Duncan, about the kind of resale value and stuff like that. But not to touch too much on tactics, but I do think it's a symptom of the modern game in that teams are preferring the high press. They want players to run 12, 13 kilometres per match on a consistent basis to press high. And teams clearly believe that having a younger dynamic in the team helps them do that more effectively on a more consistent basis than it does relying on guys who might be fit but just aren't able to do it week in, week out as the calendar continues to increase and FIFA and UEFA add more games. It's just easier to get or more straightforward to get younger talent to do that, press high consistently over 90 minutes than it is to ask older players to do the same thing.
Absolutely, and I'm told that's very much in Luis Enrique's thinking and why he's approved and asking for these type of signings.
Might be why Erik ten Hag is changing his tactic to bring in lots of young players at Man United. Maybe these young guys are the future, and we might see more of these sort of moves. And the likes of Raheem Sterling will be left on the scrap heap.
I think that's more driven by Manchester United's recruitment team than Erik ten Hag. His policy seems to be sign the 2019 Ajax team and repeat.
Yeah, I'm just waiting on Frankie de Jong. Just complete the set, guys. Just get him in. Hurry up. Get it done. Whether he's injured or not, just get him through the door.
Hey,
Hey, Prime members, are you tired of ads interfering with your favorite podcasts? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/adfreepodcasts. That's amazon.com/adfreepodcasts to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
We could do with a another strong transfer rumor of transfer rumor generator would be a great kind of computer or AI program. You could just link players at random clubs and spit out an article or something. And I think between now and the end of the window, we'll probably get two more of that Ajax side linked with Man United before things happen. You touched on Chelsea earlier, and obviously Chelsea are looking for a new striker. Do you have any info on that?
Look, there's a fascinating kind of, I don't know if it's really a tug of war. We'll see how it resolves itself. But you have Ivan Toney and Victor Osimhen, both available for differing reasons. Osimhen has a release clause and has a promise that he can leave Napoli this summer. Napoli were pushing for a fee of 130 million euros, which they know they're not going to get. And they're now in severe problems over that deal because they're struggling to find suitors. They have an offer from Saudi Arabia, from Al Ahly, for Osimhen. I understand that to be 65 million euros, which I think the chairman Aurelio De Laurentiis would be happy to take at this stage. They've been trying to push him to Chelsea and other leading European clubs through the summer. Osimhen hasn't been keen on the Chelsea move because it doesn't have Champions League football involved. And Chelsea wanted to do it on a loan basis initially. The Nigerian international, has had talks with Paris Saint-Germain through the summer and hoped that they would come in and make an offer. I've been told PSG will not do that, even at the price of 65 million euros. Even if the price goes less, I'm told they're not going to take the player now because they feel he is too expensive from a wage perspective and doesn't fit into that squad structure that we just discussed and the preferences Luis Enrique has. He's on a salary of 11 million euros net. So Napoli have a problem there if they cannot shift him out. Simultaneously, Al Ahly have been trying to sign Ivan Toney from Brentford. Toney has 1 year left in his contract. I think we've all been expecting Premier League clubs to come in for him. I think there are complications in his expectations on salary that have prevented that from happening. But there are now conversations with Chelsea over a deal. My understanding is that Toney's paid around £25,000 a week by Brentford. He's been asking for around £125,000 for a Premier League club. The offer from Saudi Arabia is a reported 20 million euros a year. Al Ahly have not met Brentford's asking fee for Toney, which has been £50 million. So there's a club-to-club discussion. I don't think this is a clear-cut one from the perspective of Brentford will definitely sell. There's been an assumption that Brentford would take what they could get for Toney in this market, given that he only has a year left. My guidance is that if they are not offered the money they expect, they would be prepared to run the contract down, believing that Toney would perform well for them for the last season, rather than sell at a discount that they feel is unacceptable. And on the reasoning that it being Toney's last chance to prove his value in the Premier League and get one of the bigger Premier League clubs, that they would get a good season out of him. I think this one essentially comes down to what Ivan Toney and Victor Osimhen are prepared to sacrifice. They've got themselves into positions where they're going to have to make a decision on whether you take the big money on offer in Saudi Arabia and push Al Ahly to get to transfer fees that are acceptable to Napoli at Brentford, or whether you go for a lesser deal and present something that's acceptable to Chelsea. And remember, Chelsea have spent the last week or two trying to justify their spending through the summer by saying that they've brought their wages down to average of 60 to 70,000 pounds per player, and it's all bonus driven. Look, I think something is going to happen here over the last couple of days, but it's not the scenario that either player envisaged going into this transfer window. It's certainly not the scenario that Napoli envisaged going into this transfer window, and they I think are the ones who have the real financial headache on their hands, because they've given Osimhen a huge salary by European standards, expecting to make a lot of money. I believe they rejected an offer of 150 million euros, a transfer fee, from PSG last summer, and this summer PSG aren't prepared to put anything down. Again, an indication of the way the overall market has changed.
Yeah, I think the Ivan Toney one as well is interesting, because you know Paul is probably saying that the ETV for him is probably more realistic now for what Brentford might be prepared to take or what clubs might be prepared to offer, because there was once upon a time where astronomical figures were being quoted for him, but I think that's different now, Paul, isn't it?
Yeah, just to touch quickly on Osimhen, I think De Laurentiis is operating, as Duncan just said, he's operating in a 2023 market in 2024. He's not been savvy enough to recognise that we're not in the same place anymore. Maybe it's happened too quick for him to really recognise it, but the numbers that have been put about for Osimhen this summer were always kind of pie in the sky based on the way that the market has played out. And he's finally accepting, not defeat, but he's accepting that, for example, our ETV figure for Osimhen is 71.1 million euros. And the numbers that Duncan is just discussing there are in and around that range. So he's clearly been a lot more realistic in terms of where we are. But the Toney one is very interesting, and it's a good case study, in my opinion, of estimated transfer value, but also what perception is around about a player. Now, Ivan Toney has played exclusively for Brentford in the Premier League. He has missed almost a year of football because of his gambling ban. He scored 4 times in 17 games when he got back. He played literally minutes, in some cases seconds, for England in the Euros in some matches. And he's never consistently delivered at the top level of the Premier League to justify such a fee, in my opinion, and in the opinion of our algorithm. So, which is why we've only got him valued at 15 million euros. Now, that might sound really, really low, right? But for all the reasons that I just mentioned, you couple into the fact that will be 29. He will have no sell-on value. He is out of contract next summer. You're painting a picture there of a guy who's just not, shouldn't be valued anywhere near that high. And if I want to make a direct comparison to a guy like Conor Gallagher, right? Conor Gallagher played every single game pretty much for Chelsea last season, played regularly for England, has got massive potential and is far younger than Toney. But for him to be considered potentially overvalued at 42 million euros, which is what we had him valued at ETV, versus Toney's value, I just find it strange. And I think a lot of it is to do with people's perception of players, what they perceive of a player in a certain position, what they can do for a team, but also how the press paints the image of that transfer. And I think in the case of Toney, everybody just expected an Arsenal or a United or someone just to come and drop 50 million in front of Brentford for Toney, and it's just not materialised. And I think some of the reasons I just mentioned have got something to do with it.
Yeah, I think that and the combination of the transfer fee, Brentford not being prepared to just sell out at low value, and Toney's expectation and salary makes the overall package extremely expensive, with the possibility you can wait for a year and the player can wait for a year and try and maximise his salary. because this is going to be the one big contract of his career. Look, I think the perception of value is slightly different with a guy like Tony because he has demonstrated that he can score goals in the Premier League, albeit a lot of them have been penalties, albeit when he came back last season, he started well but only managed 4 goals in total in the second half season for Brentford. And, you know, we mentioned Dominic Solanke earlier in this podcast, still the highest transfer fee paid by a Premier League club this season. What you were buying there, a combination of two things, what Tottenham were buying there, someone who fitted their system, as Jonathan Northcroft explained, like really well in a podcast a couple of weeks ago, but also someone who was the third highest scorer in the Premier League last season. So in the sense, you have demonstrated ability to score in the Premier League, although you caveat that with in Solanke's case, in saying that he's only done it for one season. So you do get a preparedness to pay higher sums for these players and pay them for older players when they score goals in the Premier League. But as we've seen with Tony, and as you've just indicated, Paul, it hasn't been done yet. It's gone down to the last few days. It's Chelsea who are most active at this time. And, you know, that in itself, I think, is a demonstration that the deal is priced at a high level because Chelsea are the ones who have been prepared to make strange valuation on players over the last 2 years and act on them and go through deals that other clubs wouldn't do. And Chelsea are now a mid-table club.
Probably worth referencing Amordeon at that point, the deal that fell apart. Chelsea for the Atletico Madrid striker. If rumours are to be believed, they offered $40 million for a player which ultimately ended up leaving for 15. So it shows maybe Chelsea's valuations of the market are somewhat skewed. But I do think the Osimhen and Tony deals are inextricably linked. In the case of one team, you've got a guy who's on an insane salary that Napoli simply have to get rid of him, but are operating in a market which doesn't exist anymore. When in the case of Tony, as you said, Duncan, Brentford seem pretty comfortable that they don't have to sell him. They can keep him, and it's going to be no great loss to them because they'll get him for an extra season, and he's on a relatively low salary. So it's two sides of the coin where one team has done it prudently and effectively, and the other team is perhaps a year behind what they should have done.
I think one team that we haven't touched on too much is Liverpool. They've only signed one player, or they haven't even signed a player yet. They're signing them next summer, technically, but yeah, the Liverpool have been the opposite of the anti-Chelsea this summer. They've been looking to the future. They've been keeping the squad together. They've been kind of doing everything that nobody else has been doing. There was talk that Chelsea were going to try this kind of money ball approach, this Todd Bowley money ball approach to football, and everyone would follow suit, but I'm not sure anyone's following suit. Liverpool are trying the totally opposite thing, and obviously they have Chiesa maybe getting over the line, but yeah, that's just been a maybe a breath of fresh air, perhaps, to see someone try something different. Or is there reasons behind that why Liverpool aren't signing anyone this summer?
Look, we know that Liverpool have extremely sophisticated analytical systems, and they have an ownership that believes in those systems, and they bet on the guy Michael Edwards, who was important, the leader of bringing those systems in to the club by bringing him back as I think it's a director of sport for the FSG group. I think they've also been very canny this summer in that they've used this regime change of Jurgen Klopp leaving and a new coach coming in, and the, you know, the wealth of support there is amongst Liverpool's fan base to see Slot do well, to push this argument that Slot should be allowed to work with the squad that was already established, become accustomed to it, decide who needs to be changed, who he feels needs to be changed, and take his time over the restructuring process, and they will be given time by the supporters to allow them to do that. If you look at the the activity they've tried to engage in the market, I think it supports that. They tried to sign Martin Zubimendi from Real Sociedad for 60 million euros. Obviously a very high class midfielder with great analytics who would fit into their system. In the end, he turned down the move, so that didn't happen. They went after Leny Yoro. They felt he was overvalued, and I think the entire European market, with the exception of Manchester United, feel that the money Yoro went for was an overvaluation. Maybe Manchester United will end up being right in that one, and they'll end up with one of the best defenders in the game. They could have him for over 10 years. But Liverpool felt that was too high. They weren't going to go there. They stepped aside. They tried to take advantage of Newcastle's PSR problems by going for Anthony Gordon and setting up a deal where Joe Gomez would have gone the other way, so they would have shifted out a player who's fringe for them and taken one of the most talented wingers and high-performing wingers in the Premier League. That didn't happen because Newcastle managed to solve their problems elsewhere. They signed Jorgi Mardashvili, your favourite goalkeeper, Ronan, for 35 million and 5 million of bonuses, and created a long-term succession plan for Alisson Becker, who was of interest to Saudi Arabia, had an offer from Saudi Arabia and decided to turn it down. So that could have been an even more elegant move, and that they could have taken a substantial transfer fee for Alisson, moved the wage off the books and brought in one of the top goalkeepers in world football, or a player who's considered to be one of the top goalkeepers in world football. They've looked at Mark Gehi. I think they would take him if the numbers were right, but Newcastle have pumped that transfer fee to such a level where we expect it to go through at £70 million from Crystal Palace that Liverpool have stepped away. And then, as you mentioned, Federico Chiesa, a player that they have liked for a number of years, has become available on the market for a number of reasons. One is that Thiago Motta has decided he doesn't want him in the Juventus squad because he's following a policy of bringing new significant names in, clearing out players from the old regime, and promoting academy players. So Chiesa has become available. 1 year left of contract. Juventus looking for about 15 million euros for the player. Liverpool balancing off the injury problems he's had in recent years. Only made 25 Serie A starts last season, albeit scoring 9 goals. And I think taking a calculated risk on a player who can be exceptional. So it's all very organised, very analysis-driven, very much controlled by the technical team there of Michael Edwards and Richard Hughes, and taking advantage of the fact that they don't have to do lots of stuff this summer to keep the supporters happy.
Just on the case of Chiesa, he was valued up at the 50 million euro range in our ETV. He's now run about 27.1 million euros, which it seems to be an acceptable risk for Liverpool at this point. One thing I would say about Liverpool is, yes, they are being very prudent in the market, and that's somewhat refreshing to see. But does anybody else just get a bit of an Arsene Wenger 2010-11 vibe? And by that I mean, like, Wenger kind of looked at the market at that point and just thought, that guy's just not worth that much. But then he was unable to kind of move with the times and understand where the market was at any given moment, and thought that everybody was somehow overvalued, and it meant that he probably didn't do the business in the market that he might have done in order to make the team stronger. Now, that might sound as if I'm flying in the face of everything that we've said in this podcast in terms of the overall spend, but it does seem as if Liverpool have a cohesive team and a manager who knows exactly how he wants to play, which is the antithesis to the likes of Chelsea. And in that scenario, does spending over the odds a little bit on one of these guys, which you know will make you stronger — I don't think anybody would deny that Zubimendi, even at that price, would make Liverpool stronger — does it mean that you're almost cutting off your nose to spite your face by not spending that a little bit just to improve your chances this season, even though that you know that player is inherently overvalued in your own calculations?
I think with Liverpool, they don't need to win the Premier League this year. And I think we saw the new chief executive talking about how the, on record, talking about the aim was to be competitive in the major competitions over the next few years. So if your owners feel you can get away with not winning the league, if you want to use your resource effectively over the next few seasons, if you see Manchester City likely losing Pep Guardiola at the end of the season and potentially being hit by such a heavy Premier League points penalty if this independent tribunal goes against them, that they are taken out of competition for next season, possibly for this, the end of this season, but almost certainly for next season if that comes through, then maybe this is the rational way to go. If you can get away with it, save the resource for the right moment when you have less direct competitors, and provide the, you know, one title every 5 years, that might be enough to keep Liverpool fans happy.
Yeah, I suppose that's a fair point. We are potentially looking at a transitional season here, and that City look really, really strong at the start of the season, but everyone knows what's hanging over the top of them. And I think there could be some teams that are in a bit of wait and see mode. And it does seem as if that's the case in a lot of other clubs. If you look at Arsenal, obviously they've just brought in Mourinho, but it's not exactly a blockbuster signing. And Calafiore was just another quasi-central defender to add to the pot. So it's not like they've went all out to try and improve the weaknesses of last season. It's almost like, let's truly transform this squad into something in Mikel Arteta's making, with a view to potentially doing something really big next year once this season shakes out a little bit.
Yeah, I think with Arsenal, it's staged improvements. They're taking each part bit by bit. But yes, unless they come in with a centre forward in the last part of this window, I think they're clearly not going for the Finnish model this season. I think another club to pay attention to down the years, and some people will laugh at this, is Tottenham Hotspur. I think they are financially very well placed, low wage bill, bigger revenues than they've ever had, all the infrastructure work done. If they apply their money carefully and build steadily, then it could be that they actually become competitive for the Premier League in 2-3 seasons' time. And if Manchester City are taken out of the equation, then they become even more competitive.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that's went under-remarked upon in the window, I think, certainly, if you combined this window and last window, is the amount of money that Tottenham have actually invested. It's a serious amount. Like, you don't have that huge blockbuster signing. Maybe Solanke potentially was that, but they've been chipping away at 35 to 40 million deals for quite a number of players.
Yeah,
and Ange's net spend now is actually really high across the last two seasons. So there does seem to be that pervasive thing about complaining about Daniel Levy among Spurs fans, but he's certainly backed the manager in this case, and he's given him a young squad to play in the style in which Ange wants to play. So it'll be interesting to see how Tottenham develops in the next few months.
Paul said that the Premier League, some of the other leagues were kind of doing business outside the big side in Serie A. We were seeing some of the teams outside the top of the table making moves, and I think that's, we've seen a lot of that in the Premier League, and that's probably why the figures are a billion more than any other league so far this summer. And I think West Ham are continuing to be busy on the transfer market, and they have a new player in sight before the window closes, do they, Duncan?
Yeah, they're quite a way down the line on convincing Carlos Soler to give up living down the road from L'Arc de Triomphe to play at West Ham's big windy bowl in East London, which I think is a remarkable achievement in itself. Julian Lopetegui, a big part of that, having called the Spain international direct and sold him on, and his girlfriend, on moving to London. He's very well paid at Paris Saint-Germain, 5 million net salary, 27 years of age, has not at any point kept a first team place there. started 26 league and 2 Champions League games in his 2 seasons at the club. So PSG open to selling him as they were last summer. Last summer they were asking for a fee of around €25 million, and I understand that is about the level that West Ham will end up paying for him. The club-to-club side close to being completed, but not completely done. The one delaying factor is that West Ham United owner David Sullivan, I understand, is waiting for a player to be sold, moved out, before he will approve that purchase. But if that does happen in these last few days, then we can expect Soler at West Ham United for the coming season, and we'll see how he delivers in the Premier League. He was a player who was coveted by a number of Premier League clubs before he moved to PSG.
Yeah, in the case of Soler, even as recently as last summer, we had him valued at €36 million. But given, as Duncan said, his complete lack of game time and ability to hold down a place, we've got him now valued in around the €16.7 million range. Again, he'll be 28 in January as well, which could be a factor in terms of why his valuation has fallen to that level.
And very little opportunity for sell on in a player like that. If you take a 27-year-old on that factor of salary, I don't know. I haven't asked. I don't know if he's prepared to take a pay cut to come West Ham United. But as we've discussed through this, that's basically a stage now where value drops almost to zero once you've signed him.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to get players off your books for a lot of these teams, especially ones that are getting on in years or older, a lot of money being paid to them. So yeah, it's maybe a buyer's market, perhaps, if you have money or you're willing to spend. But another team trying to sell players are Ajax. We joked earlier that maybe Man United be linked with all of their team, but yeah. Should we expect more exits?
Yes. Look, they're actively trying to sell players. They're actively trying to raise cash in these last few days of the window as they attempt to repair the damage done to their squad and done to their performance on the field by sacked technical director Sven Mislintat. The two players who are most likely to leave, I think, are Brian Brobbey, centre forward, and their 18-year-old left-footed centre back Jarrell Hato, in that they are the two most valuable players in their squad. I don't think Ajax would like to cede either of them, but they've got themselves into a position where they're having to look at offers for those players. Brobbey is of interest to Nottingham Forest, who have been working on a deal. He scored 18 goals in 30 league appearances last season. My guidance is that he does not want to join Nottingham Forest. So we'll see if Forest's Greek owner can persuade another young talent to join the club, or whether Ajax can find someone else to take the player. Paul, how do Brobbey and Hato rate on the estimated transfer market valuations that you have?
So we've got Brobbey at $19.1 million. There are caveats in that. Basically, our algorithm just doesn't value goal scoring in the Eredivisie highly anymore. Okay. There's been enough examples of guys that have scored quite a lot of goals there and went on to do very little elsewhere. So the number of goals that a player scores at any given level actively feeds into what their valuation is. So, for example, 20 goals at a higher level, the narrative is it means he's going to be worth more in his ETV. And I also think that Ajax's struggles last season don't help any of the values of these guys, simply because they weren't competing at the highest level than they might have done in the past, Champions League, for example. So that impacts Brobbey's level a little bit. Hato's an interesting one. We've got him valued at 14.4. We had him valued as highly as €27 million when he joined. But again, I think he's a victim of circumstance in terms of how poor Ajax have been, certainly in the last 12 months. But Hato is still only 18, I believe. So he's still got the capacity to go back up in value. He hasn't quite a long contract until 2020, I believe. But I think in the case of Hato, it's more that he played quite a lot last season in an Ajax team that which didn't perform very well at all. And okay. I think that's impacted on his valuation.
And he's obviously a left-footed centre-back, which is a position that's in demand for sporting directors. What kind of advantage does it give you in the ETV algorithm to be left-footed?
There's a distinct advantage in there in terms of those being more desirable players and there being less of them around, which is why when he actually signed for Ajax, we had him valued so highly. That wasn't even that long ago. His value has, I'm just looking at his chart, his value has really regressed mainly because of Ajax's problems, and that's maybe doing him a disservice, but if you are competing regularly in an Ajax team which struggles domestically to do anything, it is going to impact your overall perceived value simply because you're part of a team which is generationally bad at the moment in terms of how Ajax are positioned, and that's maybe a bit unfair for him, but it's just how the algorithm perceives outside value for a team that really isn't doing well at the moment.
So you get a bigger deficit if you are playing in a team that would be expected to do well and it doesn't do well than you would if you're...
Absolutely. There's tiers within the divisions. So especially when you go to these, your leagues like Primeira Liga in Portugal or Eredivisie, or leagues where you have two or three bigger teams that are expected to compete for the title, if not win it. And if they drastically miss the mark as much as Ajax did last season, it definitely does impact the value of all the players within that team.
Pretty interesting to see where Ajax go from here, and can they bring the value of their players back, the value of the team back, and trophies back to Amsterdam, because yeah, they're a team that's long used to winning trophies, one of Europe's most decorated teams. So yeah, it's kind of sad to see them underperforming, unless of course you're a PSV fan or a Feyenoord fan or something maybe. Paul, do you want to get us started with the villain of the week?
My villain of the piece is Todd Boehly. This summer has been a real wake-up call in making people understand that people in positions of power and billionaires may look as if they know what they're doing, but in a lot of the cases, they really don't. I've had a lot of people ask me, if what's going on at Chelsea? Is there some smart, shrewd, underlying strategy going on here? And I've tried to think about it, and I've tried to think what that could be, and I've always came up short. There isn't. There are ways of gaming the system and manipulating the system in nefarious ways, and it's basically taking advantage of the legislation of football. And I just can't really abide it. And that's before we even get to the stockpiling of talent and then treating players like garbage, treating them like they are not only surplus to the requirements, but treating them in a way that actively tries to force them out of a club. And I don't really see much of a way to justify what they're doing. In terms of how they are bringing in these players, and then as soon as they're coming in, some of them are actually actively getting moved on, and you have to question some of the agents involved in these deals. That's probably for another time and another podcast, Duncan, but if I was an agent of a player, I would be seriously considering my situation if I thought that Chelsea would be the best move for my client, because there are guys that have landed there, and I look at the case of Tosin Adebayo is a good one, in that yes, he maybe wanted to stay in London, and that maybe decided why he went for a free transfer from Fulham, but he had more than Chelsea looking at him, and whilst he's not a top tier central defender, he's gone from one playing every single week in the Premier League to maybe not featuring at all this season, and I think whilst I can call Boehly the villain of the piece, I think some of these agents need to take a look at themselves and the way that they're advising their players this summer.
Yeah, look, Paul, I think there's so much wrong at Chelsea at the moment. But following on from your excoriation of Boehly and their tactics, I'm going to make them heroes of the week. Why? For finally finding a use for Mykhailo Mudryk as the model for their punk-inspired black and pink third kit. I think he was the perfect fit to that image they put together, and it's good to see that they've found value in that uh, extortionate transfer fee and wages that they paid for the Ukrainian international.
Yeah, Chelsea obviously notoriously the punk team of the Premier League in every shape and form, as they always have been.
Three cards in the throat. You've been listening to the Transfers Podcast, powered by Football Transfers. I know I usually turn off at this point, but we have our end of window Easter egg coming in just a few seconds. So bear with us and listen to me for the next few minutes. Thank everyone. If you liked what you heard, please follow us on your favourite podcast platform and give us a rating or a review. Your support helps build a bigger audience and bring you more news, analysis and insight. You can also follow us and message us on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube at Transfers Podcast. Our Twitter address is at TransfersCast. Duncan, as always, is on Twitter and Instagram, Duncan Castles. Paul is at Paul MacDFC, and I'm at Swear I'm Not Paul, so I swear I'm not him. Our production, as always, by Mark Caulfield, Pro Podcast Production, and our music by Mark Caulfield and David L. Stay safe, be well, and thank you for listening. He did the transfer window.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy to see if you could save when you bundle your home and auto policies. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Fall is here, and if you want to sleep in the coziest bed imaginable, you have to start with Boll & Branch's best-selling 100% organic cotton sheets. You'll spend every night wrapped in buttery, breathable softness, and feel your sheets getting even softer with every wash. Discover the difference with Boll & Branch's 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off and free shipping on your first set of sheets. Visit bollandbranch.com and use code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
You've got enough on your plate. Mundane meals shouldn't be one of them. Get an endless variety of the freshest, best-tasting food from award-winning chefs delivered to your door with Cook Unity, all at a fraction of the cost and time you're spending now. Take a load off and leave your meal prep to Cook Unity. Affordable food crafted by award-winning chefs delivered straight to your door. Go to cookunity.com/podcast or enter code PODCAST before checkout for 50% off your first week.